The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. The next half hour, I'll be reading articles initially from the Harvard Women's Health Watch and possibly from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. The first article, I'm going to continue the Harvard Women's Health Watch for June 2023. And the first article is entitled, Sowing the Seeds of Better Health. Growing evidence fortifies gardening's bumper crop of physical and mental benefits. Catherine Rosa copes with winter's gloom by meticulously planning her summer flower garden, giddily anticipating pops of color and fragrance to shift her focus toward radiant days ahead. It lifts the spirit and keeps my sense of vitality alive in the dark of winter, says Rosa, a family nurse practitioner and researcher at the Benson Henry Institute for Mind-Body Medicine at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital, who's been gardening most of her life. It's a little bit of joy. Therapeutic horticulture, the practice of gardening as a means to promote better health and well-being, has existed since the 19th century. But the mind-boosting benefits Rosa reaps from digging holes, planting seeds, and pulling weeds join a veritable harvest of freshly documented health advantages. Gardening yields much the same effects on body, mind, and soul as traditional exercise, and its appeal seems to be pollinating. As of 2015, an estimated 117 million Americans kept gardens. Another 18 million took up the activity during the COVID pandemic, according to the National Gardening Association. Gardening is rarely something someone is forced to do. Most people garden because they love it, says Dr. Beth Freites, Director of Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness in the Department of Surgery at Massachusetts General Hospital. It's an activity where you literally reap what you sow. A growing body of new and established evidence offers a bouquet of reasons our body gravitates to gardening. First, it gets you moving. A study published in January 2023 in The Lancet Planetary Health suggests that gardening simply makes us move more. Researchers split 291 adults, of whom 82% were women, who hadn't gardened previously into two groups. Half were assigned to a community gardening group. The others were asked to wait a year to start gardening. Both groups took periodic surveys gauging their nutrition habits and mental health. They also wore activity monitors. The people in the gardening group increased their physical activity by about 42 minutes every week, more than a quarter of the standard recommendation of 150 minutes per week. The CDC lists gardening as a moderate intensity exercise that burns about 330 calories per hour. Just like hiking or dancing. The joy of gardening allows for physical activity that feels fun and rewarding, especially those who don't consider themselves athletes, Dr. Freight says. Some people think running, biking, or swimming are the only forms of aerobic activity. But this is a narrow view. Take advantage of the gym outside your window. Gardening improves your diet. The same study also found that participants in the gardening group ate 7% more fiber every day, possibly because they're eating what they're growing, compared with people who didn't garden. Average daily fiber intake among American adults is about half the recommended 25 to 30 grams per day, so the additional 1.4 grams eaten every day by the gardening group is substantial. Fiber can improve digestion, inflammation, and immune response. A 2021 study in the Journal of Gerontology suggests that people who garden may experience less age-related decline in immune system. They also have lower levels of low-grade inflammation, common among older adults, that can heighten the risk of cardiovascular disease, cancer, and inflammatory disease. Since gardening may cut stress, that also helps our immune system to function optimally. Along with potentially reducing your stress, gardening produces other key mental health benefits. It smooths the mood. Connecting with nature's calm can interrupt rumination, repetitive thoughts that can contribute to depression. A study published online July 6, 2022 by the journal PLOS suggests that gardening lowered stress, anxiety, and depression in otherwise healthy women who attended a twice-weekly gardening class for 4 weeks. None of the 32 women in the study had gardened previously. Half were assigned to the gardening session, while the other half went to art classes. They reported their levels of anxiety, depression, and stress. Both groups reaped mental health benefits. The gardeners reported less anxiety. Instead of focusing on the to-do list, the disagreement with a colleague, an argument with a loved one, or a difficult interaction at the grocery store, the gardener can set these worries aside to become fully immersed in the task at hand, Dr. Freight says. A 2019 study in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health suggests even a single burst of gardening significantly improves levels of brain nerve growth factors, important to staying sharp. The analysis involved 41 older adults who spent 20 minutes tending to a garden plot. Blood samples were taken before and after the gardening activity to measure brain chemicals. When you're gardening, you need to be focused, and you're also relying on your memory, Rosa says. You're continually stimulating your brain cells. When your tomato plants produce far more of the fat, juicy orbs than you can eat, what do? Pass along the extras to friends and family members, strengthening bonds in the process. Gardening also turns into a social activity. When done in community plots and with garden clubs, helping relationships bloom. If gardening is one of your social networks, you're keeping relationships that are critically important to your happiness, Rosa says. Now in the Women's Health Watch, we're going to turn to Research We're Watching. And the first article is entitled, Women with Migraines Are More Likely to Have Pregnancy Complications. Women who cope with migraine headaches before becoming pregnant may have higher risk of pregnancy complications that could threaten their health or that of their babies, a new analysis suggests. The Harvard-led study, published online January 19, 2023, by Neurology, combed through 20 years of data from the Nurses' Health Study, which included 30,555 pregnancies among 19,694 nurses in the United States. Researchers evaluated how many women reported they've been diagnosed with migraine, as well as the type of migraine. Participants also reported if they'd experienced medical problems during pregnancy. Compared with women who didn't have migraines, women diagnosed with a headache disorder before pregnancy were 17% more likely to report preterm delivery, 28% more likely to have high blood pressure during pregnancy, and 40% more likely to have preeclampsia, a serious complication involving high blood pressure and potential organ damage. These findings suggested that women with migraine might benefit from greater monitoring during pregnancy to avoid complications. Now, a second report under Research We're Watching, Healthy Habits Might Ward Off Long COVID. Women who practice many aspects of a healthy lifestyle are about half as likely as peers who don't to experience persistent symptoms after COVID-19 infection, also called long COVID. The Harvard-led study, published online February 6, 2023 by JAMA Internal Medicine, analyzed data from 32,000 women in the Nurses' Health Study. They reported information about their lifestyle in 2015 and 2017, as well as their COVID-19 status from April 2020 through November 2021. 1,900 participants were infected with the virus during that time. 44% of those developed long COVID, with symptoms persisting beyond 4 weeks after the initial infection. Women who practiced 5 or 6 of a list of healthy lifestyle habits like weight control, not smoking, regular exercise, adequate sleep, high-quality diet, and moderate alcohol consumption were 49% less likely to develop long COVID compared with women who practiced none. Of the 6 lifestyle factors, healthy body weight and adequate sleep were most strongly linked with lower risk. And then finally, another brief article under Research We're Watching. Social challenges like isolation are linked to earlier death. Our physical health likely isn't the only factor that contributes to how long we live. Social aspects of older adults' lives may influence their longevity, a new study suggests. In the Harvard-led study published online February 7, 2023 by Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, researchers interviewed 8,250 adults aged 65 and older. Within the next 4 years, 22% died. The researchers found that 8 of 183 possible factors more strongly predicted participants' death within those 4 years. Those factors included feeling isolated, meeting with their children less than once a year, not being active in their lives, living in an unclean neighborhood, feeling little control over their financial situation, not working for pay, not volunteering, and being treated with less courtesy or respect. The results suggest that social lives are as important as medical conditions in helping predict how long someone will live. They developed a 10-question survey using age, gender, and social characteristics to predict longevity that could identify people who might benefit from measures to address social challenges affecting their health. Now here's another article in the Harvard Women's Health Watch of June 2023. And this article states, conquering cancer can be a double-edged sword when survivor guilt creeps in. Here is how to move forward. After your cancer diagnosis, you put your chin down and plowed through the task at hand, beating it. But you didn't necessarily expect to be smacked with another huge challenge, survivor's guilt. This psychological phenomenon, which includes strong, persistent feelings of sadness and remorse, is an unwelcome intrusion at the end of cancer treatment, a time that should, by all accounts, be joyful. And it doesn't just include guilt itself, but also an overwhelming sense of distress, helplessness, and injustice. But the tension between trauma and relief is exactly what poses difficulty to scores of survivors who'd hope to be free of cancer's consequences, Harvard experts say. Survivor's guilt is a lot more common than we think, says Christina Pozzo-Caterman, a clinical psychologist in the Department of Psychosocial Oncology and Palliative Care at Harvard-affiliated Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Patients who express it are often met with others who minimize their feelings and tell them to just feel happy that they're okay. But admitting survivor's guilt doesn't mean you don't feel grateful. Those emotions coexist. Recent innovations in cancer treatment have led to an unprecedented number of survivors. thanks to a 32% drop in the cancer death rate between 1991 and 2019, more than 18 million people in the United States now count themselves as cancer survivors, according to a 2022 report by the American Association of Cancer Research. Their ranks increased by more than a million over the past 3 years alone and are expected to rise to 22.5 million by 2032, according to the National Cancer Institute. Cancer survivors comprise everyone who is still living after a cancer diagnosis, including those still getting treatment. Nearly 70% of survivors have lived 5 or more years since their diagnosis, and 47% have lived 10 or more years. 67% of survivors are 65 and older. But this advance presents a double-edged sword. More survivors means more battle-scarred folks who've bonded with others facing cancer and feel bereft when some of their compatriots die and they live. Survivor's guilt isn't exclusive to cancer, of course. It can also strike people who live through other types of traumatic experience, including natural disasters, mass shootings, or military conflict. Pozo Caterman points out that survivors may also face guilt that they can go on to have children when others can't, had access to good medical care when others didn't, burden their family and friends during the rigors of treatment, and tested positive for a cancer-causing genetic mutation that may jeopardize their family members. It's not just feeling bad you survived, it's many thoughts and feelings that go along with it, Pozo Caterman says. Predicting who will be affected by survivor's guilt is challenging since many factors may contribute, Harvard experts say. But you could be more prone because of unusual circumstances. Perhaps your family has been shaken by the death of multiple members from hereditary forms of cancer. Or maybe you beat a type of cancer with historically low survival rates. According to a 2019 study in the Journal of Psychosocial Oncology that polled 108 lung cancer survivors, 55% reported feeling guilty. The 5-year survival rate for lung cancer is less than 19%, according to the American Lung Association. Guilt scores among participants with the highest level of guilt reveal 5 recurring themes, including frequently wondering, why not me? I've witnessed wonderful friendships develop through cancer treatment. And when patients have friends with a similar diagnosis who don't survive, they're likely at higher risk of survivor's guilt, says Dr. Catherine Esselin, a gynecologic oncologist at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Feeling pressure to do something that confers meaning to an otherwise terrible experience can also pile on to survivor's guilt. But Pozo Caterman says it's perfectly okay if you're not inclined. If you want to, that's great, but it doesn't mean you have to. You survived, and that's enough. You don't now have to do something to validate that you survived. It's a really heavy burden. It's important not to let survivor's guilt fester. Downstream effects can include mood problems, trouble concentrating, trouble sleeping, anger and irritability, loss of motivation, and a sense of detachment. Harvard experts say you should realize your feelings are normal. It's important to not beat yourself up about them, to accept that this is the normal course of what you're going through, Dr. Esselin says. Take time to grieve. Time may not heal all wounds, but it can help you accept you couldn't have done anything to alter other cancer patients' outcomes. Find ways to work through grief. Some people plant a tree for a friend who died or participate in charity events. Others channel their feelings through art, music, or photography. There's no one strategy that works for everyone, Pozo Caterman says. In-person or online support groups can help you to connect with others who know only too well the path you're on. Some groups are geared towards survivors of certain ages or diagnoses. Programs with other survivors can often help you acknowledge feelings of guilt just by having a name for the feeling. It's very validating, and often you'll problem solve together to tackle the issues that you're dealing with. Get help. Pervasive sadness, anxiety, or depression signals a need for counseling, Dr. Esselin says. A therapist can also help you explore any underlying contributors to your feelings of guilt. And now we're going to turn to an article called The Pain Gap, again in the Harvard Women's Health Watch. When you're hurting, you want to know why, especially when pain returns day after day. So the frustration is real when a diagnosis is elusive, piling on to a cryptic but persistent gender gap in chronic pain. The lopsided prevalence of chronic pain between the sexes has long been recognized. Women deal with the problem at rates 6% higher than men. That's true for back, hip, and knee pain, migraine headaches, arthritis, lupus, and fibromyalgia, among other problems. And some chronic pain conditions strike only women, like endometriosis, the bladder condition interstitial cystitis, and vulvodynia, as well as pelvic girdle syndrome, which involves pain around the pelvic joints and lower back. What's still not clear is why. We know this disparity exists, but the question is what drives it, says Dr. Christopher Gilligan, chief of the Division of Pain Medicine at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Evidence suggests that hormones are one contributing factor. A new study found that women who got their first period at a younger age are more likely to have chronic pain in adulthood. The analysis, published in September 2022, in the journal Pain, evaluated data on 12,000 women across the full range of reported ages at menarche, that's when you first start having your period, of 9 through 18. The risk of chronic pain dropped 2% for each one-year delay in menstruation. The findings add to earlier evidence suggesting exposure to increased estrogen levels from early menstruation may contribute to pain and to overall sex differences in pain, the study author said. Even so, genes and other biologic factors may also be responsible. Adding to the burden of chronic pain is the difficulty many women have of getting a firm diagnosis. This can delay effective treatment. Dr. Gilligan offers these strategies to get the help you may need. Be persistent. If your primary care doctor can't pinpoint a cause for your pain, ask for a recommendation or referral to another medical professional. Also, if you feel you're not being listened to, seek a second or third opinion until you find a provider who does listen, he adds. Stay flexible. Before turning to medications, be open to trying different treatment approaches, including physical or occupational therapy. Consider CBT. Cognitive behavioral therapy can help alter your perception of pain and teach you coping skills. And seek support. Online and in-person support groups can link you to others who share their pain relief strategies. Some hospitals offer so-called functional restoration programs, rehabilitation programs for chronic pain sufferers that involve group support. Now, very briefly, here's a second opinion from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter of July 2023. And the question is, I know I should have a yearly checkup and stay on top of my cancer screenings and vaccines. Is there anything else I should be doing that would be covered by Medicare? And the answer is, It's always good to be proactive about your health. Keeping on top of routine cancer and chronic disease screenings called wellness visits are all great places to start. An annual wellness visit is an important opportunity for a member of your healthcare team to check on and manage basic but vital aspects of your health. This includes your weight, cognitive health, blood pressure, and medication use. Other benefits covered by Medicare Part B include depression screening. A yearly depression screening in a primary care setting is covered under Medicare. Nutrition therapy. This service is for people with diabetes or kidney disease, along with people who had a kidney transplant in the last 3 years. Nutrition therapy can include initial assessment, group meetings, and follow-up visits. Alcohol misuse counseling. Maybe you're concerned about how much or how frequently you drink. Talk to a primary care professional about screening for alcohol misuse, which is covered once a year. You may then qualify for 4 short counseling sessions at a primary care setting. Help quitting tobacco. Every year, Medicare covers 8 counseling sessions to help you quit smoking or quit using other tobacco products. And advance care planning. Advance directives are legal instructions on your preferences for medical care if you are not able to make decisions for yourself. A healthcare professional can discuss this with you and can even help you to complete the necessary forms. This is covered as part of the yearly wellness visit. Your care team may advise you to get more frequent or additional treatment beyond what is covered by Medicare. And this is discussed at www.medicare.gov/coverage. Well, it looks like we run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Yunk, and reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.